Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of the Marketplace Discussions podcast. My name is Mahmoud Resmi and today's guest is Keith Frankish. Keith is honorary professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield, UK. He is visiting research fellow at the Open University UK and adjunct professor with the Brain and Mind program in neurosciences at the University of Crete, Greece. He is the author of Mind and Supermind and Consciousness, as well as numerous journal articles and book chapters. Keith's research interests lie mainly in philosophy of mind. He is well known for defending an illusionist view of consciousness in opposition to forms of phenomenal realism. Now, in this episode, we're going to be discussing what illusionism is, but heads up to those of you who might already be familiar with the topic. This is going to be a very general and broad introduction to the argument. So we're not going to be delving deeper into the topic. The main target audience of this podcast are people who might have heard about illusionism, but haven't really read up on it, or who haven't heard about illusionism, but might be interested in philosophy in general. We also discuss other topics like doing philosophy in public, sharing ideas in the marketplace, and communicating philosophy through different channels, including blogging and through social media like Twitter. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to leave them in the comments section below if you are on YouTube, or you can reach out to me at decafquest on Twitter. Thank you very much for listening. And if you want to keep up to date with future episodes, make sure to click on the subscribe button. And thank you again for listening. I am 2 hours, 220, 230 kilometers away from Madrid. So I'm in Salamanca.
All right.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been to Salamanca.
I haven't. I've only been to Spain once, to Granada for a conference, which was in midsummer, and it was even hotter than Crete.
Right. was it humid, Granada? Like the kind of, you know, sticky humidity you have when you're in the Mediterranean? Beirut is so sticky, for example.
It was pretty humid, but it was the sheer heat getting off the plane that hit me. But it was a great event. It was a conference on language and thought back in 2015. And so we got to look around the Alhambra as well. So it's nice,
isn't it? Yeah, it's interesting because I've lived in Spain between 2010 and 2015. Mm-hmm. And now I came back to Spain last year, September 2022, and I've never been to Granada, or like I've only traveled to a few places within Spain, but yeah, never been to Granada. The last year I went to Cordoba also for a conference on philosophical heritage. Interesting stuff, but yeah.
Well, I hope to visit Spain again.
Before we started recording, we were talking about how, like, this is the interesting thing about Twitter, because I even remember the first time we interacted. We've been following each other since 2018 summer, kind of, more or less, and it was more of an altercation. I don't know if you remember as well. Or you forgot that. What do you remember how we met? on Twitter.
Was this where you picked up on my use of the word European in my bio?
Yes, indeed.
I wasn't sure how you'd read it. The reason it was there was simply as a protest against Brexit. So I was just identifying myself as someone who was anti-Brexit, a British person who was firmly regarded themselves as a European. I'm not sure what you thought it signified. You thought
it was
pretentious, I think.
Not pretentious at all. It was on strict political ground, but it was more of a projection onto you than the actual, like, because this debate, I mean, you guys are having it, I have no saying in it, you know, but then as a concept, still am a little bit maybe confused or not sure about, or agnostic about, if you want, is whether, and I don't know if you want to go there, like, I don't care if we don't end up discussing this, but it's the idea back in the day, you know, this localism versus globalism kind of debate, you know, so why does someone in a completely different country have to decide something for me? This is the idea, like, why do we have to be under the blanket of, you know, European or Arab, that it happens, or, you know, this is where I was coming from. And it was, I don't know how I got to, like, it may have been a tweet that you posted, and then I was like, man, why? And then we ended up following each other, and look at us, 3, 4, 5 years ago, we're having a discussion. Yeah.
No, I think there's an interesting debate to have there about globalism and localism. I don't want to get into political things, really. I think it was more a cultural thing. There's a certain sort of narrow-minded Englishness, and it is Englishness rather than Britishness more generally, including the Scots and the Welsh and Northern Irish and so on. There's a certain narrow-minded Englishness that I don't like culturally. I don't think the EU was ever the sort of threat to British sovereignty that many of the opponents said it was. I mean, the idea that Europe was making British laws was, I think, largely a fantasy. Certain things like the rules for the single market had to be agreed at a European level. But anyway, I don't want to get into that. But I was just protesting against that sort of narrow-minded English mentality. And also just kind of expressing my, you see, I mean, I've been living in Greece for some time, and I have a Greek family here. And in fact, one consequence of Brexit was to, and I think possibly salutary for me, was to force me to take that a bit more seriously and to recognize that if I wanted to live here, I had to, I shouldn't be here just as a British person who, thanks to the EU, was able to live here without really making much of an effort to become Greek. And so it forced me to take that more seriously and to actually take Greek citizenship, of which I'm very proud. So it may have done me a favor, actually. It may have, Brexit may have forced me to become more European, paradoxically.
Interesting.
I think it is kind of forcing people to make a choice in that way that I don't see that they should have. I think you can still, I mean, this isn't just, there's nothing sort of anti-English or anti-British about my, I mean, I love British culture. Absolutely. I love the British countryside. English countryside. I love the English countryside. I love English literature. I love English traditions. It's a lot of English culture that I absolutely adore and I identify quite strongly with. It's just the rather narrow-minded nationalism that I dislike, and that I don't think is actually really representative of the best traditions of England. But anyway, I don't want to get into
we'll not get into that. But then it's just curious this is a thing on my end also, without getting too much into detail. It's just interesting how it wasn't a fight. It was just we exchanged comments, and then you're like, okay, but so. I joke now on Twitter, I used to be angry and then I decided to read philosophy. I don't know if you've seen these tweets, but then I genuinely was angry. But then for many reasons, academia and all sorts of stuff, and one of them was that, because, you know, the debates we're having in Lebanon doesn't really matter. But then it's curious how something that started as an altercation on Twitter, which was not, again, a fight, but it's interesting how things developed. And 5 years later, we're here having a discussion.
I like to think we both handled it maturely, and That's the, I mean, you said a thing earlier, you said about projection, and I think that's what we do onto it. It's very, because the content is so impoverished, it's just a few words, sentence or two, and there's no context, and there's no facial expressions, there's none of the rich range of signals that are part of normal human interaction. It's so easy to project interpretations onto the other person, and to argue with a character you've just invented really for yourself on the basis of a very few few elements. So you've constructed this imaginary character who is saying these things in the worst possible and most in the most hostile way to you, and then you start arguing with that, and of course that becomes self-fulfilling because you're being hostile to them, and so they start projecting hostility back, and and I think Twitter invites that partly because it's so rapid, it's almost in real time, the interaction, but it's also so limited. It can easily be a very unprofitable kind of medium of communication. But if you're aware of that and just pause a little bit before you reply, just think, well, maybe they don't quite mean it like that, and just check and just say, well, do you mean this? Or do you mean that? It's once you start to break this down, and both sides recognize that there's a human being on the other side, and that the human being is probably just like themselves, just trying to make the best sense of the interaction that they can. Then you can start to talk and get to know each other. And once that happens, it's fine.
Yeah, this is so bit by bit, and I'm glad actually I joined Twitter when I did. May 2018, so that's five years now. May, we're almost we're in April, right? Yeah, April today, April 24. Yeah,
5 years.
And with time, see, this is a thing. Like at first, you know, keyboard warrior kind of stuff, but then bit by bit, I started realizing that it's not only if you're aware and then you start having these decent exchanges, and then, you know, you try to wonder what the other person, like you try to clarify things.
Yeah.
Not only that, I started using Twitter in order to get to know people. And so yeah. I stopped the debating bit. I stopped being angry and I stopped using Twitter to just vent. And instead, I started using it in a way such that I got to meet people. And It's been fruitful, nice, interesting. I got to meet all these interesting people, and including you, even though we have not met in real life, right? But then you feel like you have friends across the globe.
Yeah.
I've met some of them, and I don't even now, every time I scroll I see something I disagree with, I'm like, okay, I keep scrolling. I don't even need to engage in anything. Like it might be someone I don't know, someone I know, I follow, doesn't really matter. Because at the end of the day, if we really want to have a discussion, and maybe teaching courses online as well has helped, you see all these faces, people who would post something on Twitter in a certain way, but then they're in a class of mine and you see them and they're completely different.
Yes.
And then you're like, okay, so I don't care anymore. I'll just post jokes and I'll shit talk on Twitter in a nice way without offending anyone, and I'll just have fun. And that's it.
And it's quite a liberation, really, when you realize that you don't have to react to things that you think, it's okay. I can just let it go. They probably don't even really mean it in that way anyway, or. You know, it's maybe just a thing that just came into. I mean, I post stuff that just comes into my head, brain farts, you know, that just come into my head, and I post them. I don't expect to be sort of hauled up before a court to defend what I've just said. It was just, it's Twitter, for heaven. What I find liberating about Twitter is that when I write an academic article or something else, I sweat blood over it, trying to make it very careful, very precise, trying to say exactly what I mean. I don't always get it right, but I try hard. And that's very intimidating. It means that it's hard to write. It's hard to communicate through that medium. Now, Twitter, I just take the opposite thing. It's just Twitter. I can say pretty much anything I like. And I assume everyone knows it's just Twitter. It's just kind of fluff. And it's liberating. I can just talk to people. And I can say things that actually I can express ideas that seriously, not necessarily serious in the sense that I've really thought them out and seriously want to defend them, but ideas that I want to just try out.
Exactly. Thinker.
How about this as an idea? Yeah. It's only Twitter. If people don't like it, then I'll say, okay, fine. It's just a thought. It's an idea. What do you think?
Don't you think? See, this is also to tie it with philosophy and stuff like that. This idea that I need to defend a claim, and I need to kind of prove that my stance is correct or is right or is precise or rigorous. I guess my question is, one, why do we do that? Why does it have to be the case? And why does this mentality kind of also spill over to Twitter and real life in general? So I understand academically, like, you have to do that for, you know, because you're trying to defend an argument, etc. But then why?
I think there should be a place for trying out ideas, just trying on different ideas, as you might try on different suits of clothes. How does this fit? What does this look like? Maybe this would work. What do you think? I don't know. Where there isn't any great personal investment in it being true, and where you don't feel obliged to defend it come what may, and, you know, so just try it out. Because if we are trying to approach whatever issue it is collectively as a group, trying to find the best view that we can agree on, then it doesn't really matter whether I've got it or you've got it or someone else got it. What matters is that we kind of home in on it. So I can try out a view. I can try and make the best case I can for it, without feeling hurt, or if somebody rejects it, without feeling that if I can't properly defend it, I've somehow failed. It's just, look, here's something I'm going to try. And I think this is a really good spirit to do philosophy in, because, to do a lot of discussion, and possibly some political discussion too, because first of all, it's less stressful. You can relax a bit, and you can focus on the views and the considerations, the arguments for and against, without feeling threatened, without becoming aggressive. And I think you can think more clearly in that yeah. situation. Now, there is pressure, certainly, if you're going to publish an article, that you need to present the best case for it, and you need to try and cover every objection you can think of, and so on. And yes, I mean, that's how it works. But still, I think you can extend this approach to that and say, look, what I'm really doing here is, this is a hypothesis that I think is worth exploring, and so I'm going to give it my best shot here. But hey, if it gets shot down, that's okay. We've kind of learned something, that's a dead end. It's a much more liberating attitude to take. And the trouble is, if you do start getting personally involved, personally committed to a position, then there's a lot, there comes a lot more at stake than the truth of the position. There's your own pride becomes involved. And it's hard when you've made a personal commitment to something. It's hard to back down. If you've said, no, this is where I stand, this is important to me, this is what, then it becomes hard to say, well, maybe actually I was wrong about that. So take that personal element, that emotional element out, and I think it all becomes easier and more fun.
And this is, yeah, like, see, this is kind of, I don't know if it's a disillusionment with philosophy or a particular way of doing philosophy. Maybe it's more analytic. I don't care about divisions anymore. I'm just disillusioned with the entire kind of discipline and field. For those of you who don't know me, like, I have a philosophy background. I've taught philosophy, etc., etc. So after teaching 7 years at university, I became disillusioned. Blah blah blah. Doesn't really matter. But this, I think, see, this idea of, I have a claim, I need to defend it, and then someone else, instead of just taking the good parts of the claim. Yeah. Many end up focusing on how we can critique it, and so instead of coming up with maybe the coherent stuff and Pico della Mirandola would be a good example here. You know, syncretize things a bit, put things together, different theses. Okay, let's try to make it better. How can I make it better? No, everyone is committed. I am this, and then so everything you're going to be saying is potentially flawed, and I'm gonna find this flaw and I'm gonna break it down. And at conferences, I used to be in conferences whereby it would get quite heated between, and they're like, examples of, oh my, your stance is just stupid. It's like, why? Why do we need to? Why can't you just say, I don't agree with this, but I think what you say and here makes sense? Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Academia can be a very competitive environment. I don't know what it's to do with the, I guess it's to do with the career structure. I mean, I think most people go into academia with some idealism about it, with the idea that they are intellectual excitement and the passion for ideas and the truth. But that's not how professional academia really works. It doesn't really encourage you to do that. It encourages you to build your own CV kind of ruthlessly. And one way of doing that is by establishing yourself as someone who has a forthright views on some particular position and is and defends that tenaciously and argues with opponents, and so carves out a distinctive position with someone who goes around saying, well, yes, you know, I really like what you're doing there, and I agree with that, and I encourages other people to develop their views. You know, it's not really what's in it for you, you see. It's very individualistic in that way, I think, the philosophy. Although I think most academics would not endorse that kind of individualism. They tend to be very liberal and progressive, but it as a discipline, as a field of activity, academia is quite individualistic, about building your CV. And I think that does lead to disillusionment, precisely in those people who are most idealistic about it, which I suspect you were and still are, because I know you're still, you haven't actually given up on academia. You haven't actually given up on philosophy at all. You're approaching it in a different way.
Yeah.
You're trying to build a different sort of academia.
Yeah, but because in my case, I noticed that I am not a good fit for writing philosophy papers the way philosophy papers need to be written.
Yes.
So I noticed this personally, like when at one point I thought maybe I suck at writing, maybe I don't know how to write. Every time I had to write a philosophy paper, I would be dreading the moment. It's dreadful. But then at one point, when the pandemic happened and I started, you know, dabbling around, not only pandemic, but 2018, I started writing, and bit by bit, I started, you know, exploring new venues in writing. And when I'm not doing a philosophy paper, I noticed ideas just flow. And I enjoy sitting down and thinking about something and writing about it and posting it, a newsletter, whatever that is. So I came to the realization that, yeah, academia, in so far as a scholarly activity where I have to publish papers, the way papers have to be written, is not my thing. And so I teach philosophy, but yeah, all that other stuff, not my thing.
It is set up to be extremely intimidating, because you have to submit a manuscript, and it has to go through these rounds of reviewing sometimes it can be constructive and useful, and sometimes, you know, I've had reviewers' reports that have really been helpful, but often the reviewers just seem to be placing obstacles in your way, and it just seems there are these obstacles you have to jump over, and then you have to resubmit and jump over some more and some more. It's a very stressful process, and Yes, it's something you have to do if you're in the profession, but there are other ways of communicating through blogging, say, and podcasting, indeed, which I think the thing is, academics, academics do communicate through journal articles, certainly, particularly if one becomes well known and is widely read and cited. So journal articles can be a means of communication within the academic community and even beyond it. But most don't become that. Most are not widely cited and widely read. And really, they are just there to be items on your CV that will move you towards tenure or towards a promotion or whatever. And that's the function they serve. And if you're lucky enough that one of them actually does take off and get read and cited and so on, it becomes a media critic, fantastic. But that's not the sole or even the primary purpose of publishing. It's a career thing. And whereas blogging, podcasts, this kind of thing, their purpose is entirely communication. There isn't a lot of kudos, academic career. There's not a lot of career points you gain from blogging or doing podcasts. But in terms of communication, both I think with a scholarly audience and with a wider one, then they work much better.
And
And
this
I
is,
that's one thing that encourages me about what's happening in academia recently. It's this sort of para academia that's developing, academics building a community around the university. It's often they still have connections to the universities. They've either worked in them, they're in academic positions, or they're still affiliated with them. But they're operating, they're ranging outside the walls. And I'm not sure where this metaphor is going, but they're, they're leaving the citadel and,
Yeah, exactly. Bringing philosophy, like this is my tagline at one point, bringing philosophy back to the marketplace. And
Absolutely.
again, not as a criticism of academia as such, because many people do it, like it can be competitive, etc. Yeah, maybe the system needs to be re-examined, restructured a bit when it comes to publish or perish and stuff like that. Understandable. But then in general, many people can write and enjoy writing, etc., within a scholarly kind of framework. Good for them. But then it's the opening up that is the issue here. It's okay, let's bring philosophy back to the marketplace or any other discipline. And this is something that you've been doing for I don't know actually how many years. Like you've been talking to people outside of academia, trying to, communicate the ideas that you and others have, and having all these debates in public, exchanging ideas, developing some sort of community. So, yeah, this is like how did you, or what got you to think, okay, I need to open up, and this is important.
Yeah, that's a good question. Any question about how my using career here in a fairly loose sense developed is difficult for me to answer, because what I will do is I will give you some story, some kind of rationale, reconstruction. But it was never planned. Things happened by accident, by just a combination of circumstances. And looking back, I can try and piece it together and say, oh, this is the narrative that was there. But it certainly wasn't any part of a planned strategy. I mean,
But was it, for example, like say, because deciding to join Twitter, for example, is already a step forward, right? Like, or I don't know if you were using like other, if you had a blog before that, or so it's many people are kind of wary and hesitant to jump into the social media sphere, for example.
Well, that's easy to answer. That was when we moved to Greece, which was originally on unpaid leave from our, I say our here to refer to Maria, my partner, from our UK posts, partly for family caring reasons. And we came here to Greece, and I was isolated. I missed just standing at somebody's open door, open office door, and just asking what they were doing, making jokes, water cooler stuff, you know? Maybe suggesting something for them to read, or they're suggesting something for me, or just being silly. I missed that. And it was just started, this was way back in 2008, 2009. And there was this thing starting up, Twitter. And there were a few people I knew on there. And there was also a little community then, the early philosophy Twitter community. There was some of the people are still around there from that early community. It was a small community, and they're all very friendly. And so I said, oh, this is a bit like what I miss. And so I could just talk about what I was reading and make my silly jokes, and people would just chat. And I just felt like I was back in touch with people. And I liked it. And it was a nice, friendly community. There was very little, well, there was no aggression really among this community. And so, yeah, I just carried on. And what happened was gradually, because I've been there a long time, gradually I started to build up larger and larger number of followers over the years. It just, if you stay long enough, you get people follow you. And of course, the more you get, the more visible you become. And so, at least maybe until recently, and so more and more people, you know, the curve starts to become steeper. And I found that there's this wonderful thing. I could post a thought on there, and lots of people would respond to it. I generally, in a positive way. And if they weren't positive, I'd either ignore them or just try and diffuse the situation, a bit of humor or something. And so I think people gave up trying to argue with me because they realized that I wasn't going to respond. So they didn't get any rise out of me. And so gradually, I was in this wonderful position where now I can just sit there and I can type one of my, I can wake up and think, oh, here's an idea, you know, something half-baked, right? I type it into Twitter and lots of people will respond. And it's just kind of, it's a great privilege to have all these people just listening to my nonsense. So it's really been a positive thing for me. It's kept me in touch. And as you say, I've made so many friends through it. There's so many people around the world who I'd never have I've got in touch with. And also, people who email me will know this. I'm much more responsive on Twitter than on email, because
Right.
someone sends me an email, it's kind of a bit like formal writing again. And
Exactly.
if someone says writes me questions, you know, your illusionist view is okay. What do you think about this? I think, all right, that needs a proper response. That needs a couple of paragraphs of carefully considered prose in response to that. Somebody on Twitter says, what's this you're saying then? That doesn't make any sense. So I just go back, well, actually, I think it does make sense because of this and this. And they come back and say, what are you saying that? And I say, well, not exactly that. I'm sort of saying this. And, you know, because it's just a couple of sentences, and because it's Twitter and it doesn't really matter, I respond quite quickly. So the people who know me have worked out that the best way to communicate with me is through Twitter or through direct messages on Twitter. Whereas I'm a slow correspondent. So I love Twitter.
Yeah, it's see, this is something that happens with me as well. Like, I receive an email, and because of the formality of the email, I also think I need to sit down and properly respond. I'm not gonna write it on my phone, etc., etc. But then when with Twitter, you're like, yeah, whatever, I'll just respond, and
Exactly.
it's immediate. And you know, there's, I mean, consequences sometimes if things go too far, of course. But then if you're within the, you know, parameters of the acceptable, things are not gonna escalate, and then that's it. Exchanges and yeah, it's so this is as such, because you have, or the term that you coined to describe the philosophical stance that you advocate is illusionism, which we're going to be discussing. But Before we get there, so when was the paper written, the whereby you described, okay, let's call it illusionism, and it picked up?
Yes.
Was that
Well,
before or after Twitter?
oh, that was after. I'd in the early part of my career, the first half of my career, I'd not worked on consciousness at all. I worked on the nature of belief and the scientific status of folk psychology and nature of reasoning. So all on the cognitive side. And I've worked on dual process theories of reasoning in collaboration with some psychologists. And so that had been my big thing. And I'm still interested in that, actually. I might go back to it. But then I started getting interested in consciousness in the 2000s. When I was working at the Open University, I worked as a central academic at the Open University, the UK's Open University, Milton Keynes. The job was essentially r writing course material that would be then taught by the associate lecturers around the country. The Open University works by distance learning. And one task I had was to write a course book on consciousness for a philosophy of mind course. It was something I had an interest in, but I'd not done much on it. So it gave me a chance to just familiarize myself with the literature. And I got quite interested in it, and I wrote a little paper at that time called "The Anti-Zombie Argument: A Response to the Zombie Argument," which went down fairly well. Well, that wasn't exactly an illusionist paper; that's a bit more complicated. But I'd always been very attracted to Dan Dennett's Daniel Dennett's approach to consciousness, and indeed to philosophy of mind generally. And writing this book gave me a chance to reread his stuff and to get a bit more deeply into it and to see how much I really liked it. And I mean, Dan Dennett doesn't need my defense by any means. But I felt that
Yeah,
he
and parenthesis here for those who might
yes.
not know, what's Dan Dennett's view on consciousness?
Right. Well, it's essentially the view that I, for which I coined the label illusionism. It's a, well, now, yes, now we get into the whole issue of what this view is. Let's just say to begin with that it's a view that challenges a lot of the assumptions people have about consciousness. It challenges the way people, particularly philosophers, I think, tend to conceive of consciousness. Okay. One way, that Dennett presents it is as a rejection of what he calls the Cartesian theater view. And this is the idea that consciousness is a sort of inner show, like a sort of inner, this like sort of inner cinema screen and inner audio equipment and so on. And there's a self in there that is watching this show on this inner screen, this audio visual show, and smell and all the other senses. And so there's the outer world here around us, which is bombarding us with stimuli. And then somehow our brain is creating this private show inside that is appreciated by self or something that's somehow in here. Now, Cartesian, because reference to Descartes, René Descartes, who thought that really was something like this. There was this observer, this spectator in the Cartesian theater was this immaterial soul, and it was communicating with the brain through the pineal gland in the center of the brain. And what the brain was doing was kind of sending all this information to the soul, which was sitting there watching it all. All the sensory information was assembled, broadcast through the pineal gland, and the soul kind of appreciated. I mean, that's a caricature. It's all a caricature, but it's a view that's shapes people's thinking about it. And Dennett's point was that, okay, nowadays, there aren't many Cartesian dualists around, people, at least in philosophy, who think that that the mind is a separate substance, an immaterial soul. They think that really the mind is just produced by the brain. But his point was that they still are, their thinking about consciousness is kind of infused with this metaphor of there being a presentation to a self. Okay, so there are all the colors of the things around me in the world, and then there are the mental colors that my brain somehow creates and that are appreciated by my consciousnesses, by my inner self, as it were. And he thought that this view, this picture, influences a lot of people who would say, no, I don't have that sort of Cartesian picture at all. But he thought they were conceptualizing consciousness in a way that was still influenced by this picture. He talks about the pull of Cartesian gravity on people, on theories. And so his, and I'm referring here to his 1991 book, Consciousness Explained, primarily, but there are other important works. And so he tried to get people to see that there's another way of looking at consciousness. You don't have to conceptualize it in this Cartesian way. There's an alternative and a better one. And now Dennett, as I say, doesn't need my defense at all, but I felt that this was a very, very attractive and important view. And I felt that people didn't take Dennett's work seriously enough. Most people respected him hugely. They praised, you know, his intelligence and so on and so on. But a lot of them said, yeah, but on consciousness, yeah, well, that doesn't really explain it, does it? That's just, they said the book Consciousness Explained should have been called Consciousness Explained Away, because he was kind of not addressing the real heart of the issue as they saw it, which of course is precisely the point, because what they see as the heart of the issue is what he thought was a misconception of consciousness. And so I thought, well, look, if I'm going to do anything here, I'm going to add my voice to this. That's, I think this is the right view. So let's see if I can help promote it, really. And now Dennett had often referred to this conception of consciousness, this Cartesian theater conception, as involving a sort of illusion. So I thought, well, so he'd often use this notion of illusion, and he'd spoken about, he'd used comparisons with magic. Stage magic's like a trick that your brain plays on you. And so I thought, you know, illusionism. and I like that term because it wasn't wholly negative. It wasn't, there are other terms that are sometimes used for people who are rejecting a certain view of something. You could say that you're being an irrealist about something, or an eliminativist. You're trying to eliminate a certain way of thinking. Or you're going to be an irrealist and deny the reality of something. Now they sounded negative. And I wanted to say, well, no, it's that there really is something here that is powerful and inducing us to conceptualize it in that way. Just as when you go to see a magic show, something is happening there that is inducing you to interpret it in a certain way that isn't correct, but it's designed, as it were, to make you conceptualize it in this incorrect way. That's the whole point of the magic show. So I thought that illusion is a more positive term. It's conceding that there is this Cartesian gravity, this powerful pull towards this Cartesian picture. And so I thought, illusionism. And then I started developing this idea just around 2014. And at that time I was lucky to be invited by Dennett to take part in a cruise in Greenland that was organized by the Russian the Moscow State University and their what is it called, I can't remember the name of the center. There's a center there that's funded by a Russian businessman who's very interested in consciousness. He's a philosopher himself. And so there was this cruise was being organized in Greenland for leading philosophers of consciousness. I was lucky enough to be invited along. And so I presented these, my take on this there. And went fairly well, I think. And it was actually David Chalmers who suggested to me that I should call the paper that I was writing on this illusionism as a theory of consciousness. I've been going to call it something like the magic problem. But he said, no, call it the illusion problem, and call the paper illusionism as a theory of consciousness. So he gave me some very helpful comments on that. Anyway, and so that gave me a big stimulus. And then that paper then came out a couple of years later in a special issue of Journal of Conscious Studies with a whole bunch of responses from people, some of whom have been on the cruise. And I wrote a reply to that. And then that was published as a book. And that sort of established this as a, at least as a name for this position. It didn't really have an established name. And so I think just supplying the name helped a lot to focus attention on the position. And what had also been happening around this same time was that another bunch of people in conscious science, I'm talking a lot here without letting you get away and do interrupt me, was a lot of people, philosophers of consciousness, have been moving in precisely the opposite direction. Instead of questioning this sort of Cartesian conception, they were taking it very, very seriously and saying that, yes, there is this inner nature, this inner private nature to us as conscious beings, and it can't be explained in terms of processes in the brain. It has to be some fundamental feature, and the only way really to explain it is that everything has a little bit of this inner nature, this private inner nature. Even fundamental particles, electrons, have it. So it's a fundamental feature of the universe. So far from being an illusion, it's actually an absolutely fundamental feature of all matter. And that's panpsychism. And actually, one of the leading panpsychists, Philip Goff, was on the cruise too. And so what was happening in conscious studies, it seems, was there's this, at least one thing that was happening in conscious studies, was that there was this move towards the extremes, if you like. Well, I don't see my position as extreme, I should say. I think it's just common sense. But anyway. So people saw it as extreme. And so that, again, made illusionism seem, and panpsychism seem like the two big heavyweights who are fighting in this area. And then, of course, I started doing some podcasts with Philip too, and we promoted this friendly competition.
For people who know about this debate and stuff, forgive me, my questions are going to be very naive, and because I genuinely am trying to understand things from different perspectives. And as I see it, what you and Dennett are trying to do is, like, the assumption is, or you're basically just trying to say there is no mind. It's all rooted in physical kind of substratum of the universe. Like, it's the brain, and the brain is playing tricks, and we think there's something more to it, but then there isn't. It's sophisticated, complicated, whatever you want to call it, but then it's not that thing. So you're basically just trying to explain away the non-material aspect of it, whereas people like Philip Goff are saying, I don't understand what this consciousness is. It might be physical as well, or it might be a little bit more than physical, but then it's essential, like it's the building blocks, if you want. So I don't know if this makes sense, but then so I don't know, like is this something similar? Well, is this what you and Philip, but let's focus on your stance here. Is this sort of what you, like, said differently, why is this important?
Right. No, that's a very good question. Am I trying to,
not deny, but then just like, because you're saying the Cartesian, you know, the mind, yes. Well, there is no mind as such, you know, spiritual, non-physical stuff.
It's more a matter of what the mind is and what consciousness is. I'm not saying we don't have minds, we don't have consciousness, we don't.
No, of course, but then the nature of this mind is.
I'm asking to reconceptualize, or at least consider the possibility that we might need to reconceptualize what we mean by the mind and consciousness and pain and so on. Now, certainly, you know, we have, let's just start with something that's uncontroversial. We have all this way of talking about ourselves in terms of mental states, and we talk about like pains, and we talk about seeing things and hearing things and smelling things and tasting things, and we talk about our minds, and we talk about what's happening in our minds, and we maybe talk about things like, you know, private thoughts that we have, and secret desires that we don't tell anyone. That's okay. Yeah, well, we have all this, and this talk isn't just like nonsense. It's not just idle talk that doesn't refer to anything at all. Of course, this is tracking some very important aspects of our lives, very important things that are happening. When someone's in pain, that's a very significant thing that's happening to them. It's a bad thing that's happening to them. It's the thing they want to stop happening. And it's the thing that what we should try not to cause to happen. That's just, everyone agrees on that, I think. You know, there's no question of denying any of that. The question is, what is actually occurring? What are those terms actually tracking when we talk about pain? What is actually happening? Now, we have a way of conceptualizing this that tends to invoke these Cartesian ideas of the mind being somehow a private world that's separate in some sense from all the neuronal processes that are happening in here. There's all these neurons firing, massive neurons and glial cells and all sorts of other stuff, all tightly packed into here, and waves of electrochemical activity spreading over throughout these networks in there. It's all massively complicated, and neuroscience will tell you quite a bit about that, though we're still at a very early stage. But the mind seems somehow to be somehow something different from that. The neuroscientist investigating your mind, your brain wouldn't be able to see your mind, wouldn't be able to enter into your mind and see what's happening there. It seems like a private world that only you really know. And you here seem to be somehow the occupant of this mind or the possessor of this mind, but something again different from the physical organism, from the biological organism. There seems to be a self somehow in there that is situated in this private world. And what's in that private world seems to be something like it seems that all the world around us it's stimulating us, light and pressure waves in the air and odor molecules in the air. And what's happening is that's somehow creating this inner world of sensations, of color sensations and sound sensations and smell sensations and pain sensations that again belongs to this private world and it's connected with the outer world, it's produced by the outer world, but is somehow distinct from it. And maybe this inner world could exist without an outer world, maybe, as when you're dreaming or hallucinating or whatever. And maybe indeed this private inner world and the self could even survive the death of the physical.
Yeah.
This is the conception that we have, and it's a very tempting conception, and I think that in itself is a really interesting thing. Why are we so inclined to conceptualize ourselves and our minds in that way? Now, and there certainly is something real happening, some very, very complex happening, but the suggestion is maybe that we shouldn't take that picture, that Cartesian influence picture, literally. We should see it as something like our metaphor, our way of conceptualizing what's really happening, which is a hugely complex patterns of activity within our brains.
Because you're saying so, but maybe our brains are playing tricks on us, or maybe they're tricking us into thinking that or to perceive the world in a certain way and to assume that the processes are like this when in fact things are more complicated than they actually are, or whatever that is. But this is the thing, it's like when we say our brains are playing a trick on us, isn't this somehow the same idea? But instead of saying that, instead of conceptualizing as a mind that is separate in the private world, well, maybe somehow the brain, and I don't know if I'm going to be making sense here, but Isn't this the same metaphor, but then applied to the brain instead of the mind? Because there's something that is triggering all this illusionism of things appearing to be in a certain way when they aren't. But then where is this taking place? Like, who's doing that?
Okay, well, there's a way of thinking about illusion that, again, is a Cartesian way. If you think about, suppose that I'm hallucinating something in the world around me. I'm hallucinating seeing a pink rabbit, say, okay. Now, there's a way of what's happening there. Well, there's a way of thinking about that that is a Cartesian way, that what's happening is somehow my brain is creating the image of a pink rabbit in this Cartesian theater that my self is then observing. And that's what it is to be, to hallucinate a pink rabbit, or to be under the illusion that something that isn't a pink rabbit is a pink rabbit. Okay, so there's a fluffy sort of odd shape there, and I see it as a pink rabbit. The idea is that my brain is creating an image of a pink rabbit, and that's what I'm really immediately aware of, and I'm mistaking another thing in the world for it. Now, obviously, it's not how I'm going to think of illusions, because if I then say, oh, well, this inner world is an illusion, then okay, so if we think about it in that way, then that would mean that there'd have to be another Cartesian theater in which this image of the first Cartesian theater is presented to another subject. Okay. If I'm saying this stuff is an illusion, then where's the theater where that illusion is being presented? Okay. Well, obviously, I'm not going to think of it in that way, am I?
So
I'm not going to think of illusions, perceptual illusions, in these Cartesian terms. So I'm going to say that to hallucinate a pink rabbit is simply to be reacting to the world as if there were a pink rabbit there, for all the various reactions that a pink rabbit would produce to be occurring in me. For instance, I mean, to believe that there's a pink rabbit there, I mean, to dispose to say that there's a pink rabbit there, all the, not just those simple reactions, but all the host of reactions that would occur if there really were a pink rabbit there. That's me to be under the illusion that there's a pink rabbit there. Similarly, to say that it seems to me that there's this inner world, there's me to be all the reactions that such an inner world would create to be occurring in me. So I'm going to understand illusion in terms of a whole pattern of reactions, either to the world or to myself. Okay, I'm not going to want the illusion to be rendered in some sort of image.
Yeah, and so this is where the naivety comes in, kind of, because so who's reacting?
The organism.
And in the case of, so let me see if this maybe makes sense. So we're just an extension of nature somehow, and then we become an organism, and this organism reacts in a certain way so as to appear that we have selves and we have all sorts of stuff going on. Like, because when we say, you know, organism, how does this distinguish us, if at all, from other organisms? This is one, and two, so does this mean that there is, so what is going on is another way of saying it with the human body.
If the question is what distinguishes, you know, this bit of the world from the rest of the world, in one sense, nothing. This is just a part of the world. Okay. There's nothing metaphysically special about this bit of the world. There isn't some extra ingredient here.
Yeah.
You couldn't find elsewhere in the world.
Of course.
But that isn't to say that this bit isn't special and distinct. It's a highly complex arrangement of the stuff that you find elsewhere in the world that is reacting to the world that has been designed by natural selection, by evolution over thousands of millions of years, to respond to the world in very, very sophisticated ways. So there's all sorts of things happening. There's layers of representation. It's convenient to talk in terms of representation. Let's just talk about layers of response. There are stimuli impact upon sense organisms of this bit of the world, and hugely complex patterns of responses occur within. Okay, physiological responses, first of all, some things will make my heart beat faster, make adrenaline start pumping. Psychological responses, memories, beliefs, emotions are triggered, and I can explain what those are in non-Cartesian terms. Obviously, behaviors produced that react overtly, massively complex patterns of response, and self-responses. I don't just respond to the world, I also respond, this bit of the world doesn't just respond to the world, it also responds to its own internal state. It tracks what's happening inside it as well. So when the heart, when this heart starts pumping fast, stuff in here registers that and responds to that too. Okay, and when things happen in here, when beliefs and memories are formed, they have further effects in here. Complex loops of activity in here, massively complex loops. And this makes this bit of the world very, very different from the other bits of the world that are much less sensitive to what's going on. I mean, take something like a plant, that is quite sensitive, that is very sensitive to all sorts of stimuli that happen to it, very, very sensitive to nutrients in the ground, all sorts of things. Plants have ways of signaling to each other also. But in comparison with this bit, they're relatively simple. This bit is massively complex. And one of the consequences of all this massive complexity and this self-monitoring and so on is that this bit of the world tends to say things like, I've got this private world in here, and I'm absolutely convinced that there's a sort of private thing in here that is something separate from the processes that scientists talk about that are happening there. That's one of the effects due to these complex layers of sensitivity and self-monitoring and so on. And this bit of the world tends to tell these stories about itself in terms of a private self and an inner world, and having the ability to make free decisions that are not the product of causal processes around it and within it. And so on. And it spins this narrative, and that narrative is capturing something. It's this bit of the world's way of gesturing at the huge complexity within it and the processes that are happening within it, which it doesn't understand. Okay, and it's a way of enabling this bit, this complex bit here, to communicate with other similarly complex bits and to tell them what's happening within it. Oh, I'm in that state again, that state of pain that is horrible. You know what I mean? You're often in it. It's horrible, isn't it? I don't like it. I want it to stop. That's responding to some complex pattern of reactions that are occurring within this bit of the world. Now, of course, it's difficult to, as you see, I'm trying to tell that story here by talking about this bit of the world rather than me and I, and rather than using personal pronouns, because then you wonder, well, what are those referring to? Are they referring to a self or whatever? Or yeah, what is this self? Yeah. So I tried to say it just talking about this complex bit of the world, but it's very difficult to talk in that way. And it's not surprising that isn't the way we naturally talk. We naturally have this much more Cartesian infused way of talking about ourselves because it's convenient. Okay, we can't just describe ourselves as in neuroscientific terms, or maybe perhaps, I don't know, perhaps.
But see, this is like my, and I kind of get the view a little bit more now, mm-hmm. and I don't have any objections. Let's put it this way, but. How is this, and we'll discuss this even further, because it's interesting to try to understand it, because again, I don't see a problem with it at first glance. But how is this different from panpsychism, for example, Philip what Philip Goffs advocates. Because to me, and people, many people who are not involved in any of this debate, right? Like those who know absolutely nothing about the philosophy of mind, why? To us, it might seem like, what? Why does it matter to think it's this view or that view? It's consciousness across all organisms as a fundamental kind of property versus this illusionism of consciousness that is undergirded by all these complex mechanisms. The first question is how does this differ from Philip Goff's, and the second question is, to someone who is not involved in any of this, why would we care in the, like, okay, let's try to convince me or not. No, it's, but why do we even need to think about this? How will this help us, like, if one view or the other is more correct, how is this going to be changing the way we perceive the world in a more like practical way, let's say? Okay.
That's a good question. Let's start with the first one. How does that differ from what I would call the phenomenal realists, of which panpsychism is a form? Now, you have to be aware here that I'm caricaturing my own position. I'm also caricaturing their position. But roughly, it's that phenomenal realists, they take our... they trust this sense that we are acquainted with this private mental world. They think that there are mental qualities, it's called qualia, phenomenal properties, what it is, likenesses. The idea is that colors, say, take colors are the ones that people, that philosophers tend to focus on. Colors, the colors in the world that are, as it were, like surface properties of objects. Light bounces off those objects. Certain wavelengths are absorbed, certain are reflected. Light hits our eyes. And this produces somehow in us a mental quality, a mental color, okay? A mental, so yellow thing there, light's bouncing off it, and that's producing a mental yellow in me, which might be different from the quality produce yellow things produce in you, for all we know. So there's this private world of mental qualities, and this is the show in the Cartesian theater that I talked about. Okay, so this is qualities of things out there produce qualities in here.
Yeah? But then the yellowness might be different?
Conceivably, because I don't
for people like Goff and panpsychists, if I'm understood correctly.
The thought is, for anyone who takes this, what I've been just calling the Cartesian theater,
yeah,
seriously, for anyone who takes, not just panpsychists, but anyone who takes that picture seriously, who isn't an illusionist, I guess, then it's going to be conceivable that these qualities, seem conceivable, at least, that these qualities are, could be different in different people, because the point is, the show in the theater is there only for the individual themselves. Only I get to see my inner show. Only you get to see your inner show.
But then the yellowness outside?
We can all agree that whatever surface property that thing over there has, we're going to call it yellow. Okay, so we all agree that whatever surface property, light reflecting property bananas have, that's we call yellow. Okay, so we all agree
but
on that.
The subjective experience is different.
The subjective experience. Okay. The show in the Cartesian theater, the quality produced there might be different. Maybe yellow looks different to you than it looks to me. It's private. And science isn't going to settle this. Science may tell us that there are certain things happening in our brains, and they may say that what's happening in your brain is very similar to what's happening in my brain, or they might say it's very different or whatever. But that doesn't really settle it unless we know how what's happening in the brain correlates with what's happening in the private Cartesian theater. And that's something that science can't tell us, because science has got no access to this private mental world, you see. So there's a world here that is outside the scope of science. And this is how, so phenomenal realist, when a phenomenal realist, I mean somebody who takes seriously the existence of these this, this private world of qualities, mental qualities, phenomenal qualities, phenomenality, the character of this inner world, this private world. Now, so if you take that seriously, if you are a phenomenalist, then there's a question here that science isn't going to settle, which is about the relation between this private mental world and the world that science can describe, the world of neuroscience. Okay, right. And that's a philosophical question now. So you've got to talk, you need some theory about how this private mental world correlates with the public world of neuroscience and the rest of the sciences. Now, so that's the key key difference is that between my sort of view and the phenomenal realist view is that phenomenal realists take this, I've been characterizing it as the Cartesian theater view, and they might not like that term, but they take this idea of the reality of these mental qualities, that they take our sense that these mental qualities exist, they take that seriously, they believe in the reality of these mental qualities, okay? Whereas I say, yes, there's a certain sense in which they seem to exist, in which we're kind of strongly disposed to conceptualize our minds in that way, but I don't trust it, okay? I do think the talk of these qualities, as it were, is reflecting something that's happening, but I think it's distorting it, okay? So we shouldn't just take it at face value, okay? We shouldn't just accept, yeah, it seems like there's this world of mental qualities, therefore there is one. And therefore we've got this big philosophical problem of how that private world is related to the public world described by science. I say that image that we have, that picture that we have, is capturing something, but it's not to be taken literally. It's more like a metaphor, a fiction, an illusion. So if you take it seriously, if you think, yes, there really are these mental qualities, then okay, then, as I said, you have this question of how they're related to the public world, to the world described by science. And one option is to say these mental qualities, we can't explain how the brain produces them. No account of brain processors explains the feel of the experience. So we have to take the feel as a fundamental feature of reality. Somehow, when you get these brain processors, you get that feel. It just happens, and we can't explain that. That's just how reality is. Okay, and that's a sort of dualism. Panpsychism tries to be a bit more elegant about this, and it says, "Well, look, actually, this inner aspect that we have, this private aspect, this intrinsic nature that we have, that's all of reality has that. It's a fundamental feature of the world. The fundamental physical particles all have a little inner nature like that. They all have a little Cartesian theater, though they wouldn't use that term because it seems derogatory. But they all have an intrinsic nature, a sort of what it's like, a private nature that is not detectable from the outside. Okay, so they all have this, if you like, this little inner life, as it were, not a life in terms of biology and reproduction, but an inner quality to them. Okay, so they have intrinsic nature, and that's a fundamental feature of all.
Does it include knowledge?
No,
of some sort. So it's just a.
It's not cognitive. It's not psychological.
Quality. It's just a quality.
You see, we have to gesture when we do this, because, and I think there's a reason we have to gesture, because it is just a metaphor. But he was words like feel, or what it's likeness, a quality, and subjective aspect, okay, an inside-ness, a quality that's only there for the thing itself, that isn't there, that isn't detectable by from the outside. We have this notion of inner and outer, you see, which is employed here. And again, I think that's a metaphor, but panpsychists and others take it seriously. So they say that fundamental particles have this inner nature. And that inner nature is like a very, very, very minimal version of consciousness. It's a little, tiny little spark of consciousness. And what the reason we have this big flame of consciousness, this big fire of consciousness, is because all the little sparks of consciousness in the particles in our brain have somehow combined to create it. So it's not a real kind of mystery as to why brains should have this complex inner life. It's a combination of the tiny little sparks of inner life that all the particles of the brain have, just as the large structure of the brain that's described by neuroscience is a product of the putting together of the atoms in a certain arrangement and in a certain structure. So it's where you put atoms or elementary particles together in a certain structure, and you get a brain. You combine their inner natures at the same time, and you get a consciousness. So it's a sort of a mirror of the structure of the brain in the structure of consciousness. Now it's an elegant way of explaining how you get to this.
And without getting there, just correct me if I'm wrong, because this reminds me a lot of Leibniz.
Monads, yes.
But because this can take us elsewhere, but it's something similar to that. Like, you know,
there's certainly connections that I don't think Leibniz sees.
No. But as an idea, combination, you know, like in that these. Okay, but this idea of have a certain quality to them, and then the combination of it.
I don't think they combine on Leibniz. I think each one is applied. Each one, true. Each moment, yeah. Is its own, yeah, independent world, yeah, sealed, yeah, off from all the rest. There is one that is the prime monad, that is ourself, but that is not the product of combination of the other monads. They're all separate worlds. Each one is completely insulated and contains all its future development within itself, I think, but I'm not a Leibniz scholar. But there are similarities, certainly.
Okay, and so, but this is, again, interesting. This the difference there, the difference is that they have this preset somehow quality.
Mm-hmm.
How, given this key difference, how does this shape or influence the way how do we go forward? Like, how does this lead to more practical kind of ways of conceiving of all that and dealing with all that?
Okay, so why does this matter, in short? Well, one thing, that is because we want to understand what consciousness is. And if it's a fundamental feature of the world, that's a very different view from saying that it's just a complex pattern of reactivity within evolved biological systems. So, you know, we want to know the truth, I suppose. So at one level, it's just a matter satisfying our curiosity as to what it is. But I think there are other more practical implications. One is for science. I mean, if you have a realist view, if you think that there are these mental qualities, phenomenal properties that are somehow associated with brain states, then you have this question of, well, which brain states are they associated with? Take pain. Which brain states are associated with this quality of pain? And that's expressed as the search for the neural correlates of consciousness. Okay, the idea is here that finding these structures in the brain that correlate with a particular experience, such as pain, those, just finding them won't in itself explain the pain, because there's more to it, as it were, than just the occurrence of those neural processes. Okay, there's the pain, but those processes somehow cause or produce the pain, or when they occur, then the intrinsic fields of the particles involved fuse to form the pain feeling. Okay, but we're still useful to identify them so that we could know, for example, when people are in pain. I mean, if somebody is unconscious, well, let's take an animal. Let's take fish, say. If we could find the neural correlates of pain, the neural states that have to be present for pain to occur, then we could say, do those states occur in other animals? And if they don't, then maybe we conclude they don't feel pain, even if they tend to behave like it. So there's this project of trying to look for the neural states that correlate with various experiences, search for the neural correlates of consciousness. The problem with that is, of course, that you're never going to be able to, you're not going to be able, science on its own isn't going to be able to answer that question of what the neural correlates are. It will can tell you what's happening in the brain. And you can get the reports from the subject, maybe if they're human, they can say what they can report on how they're feeling. But you still need a theory about how those brain events and those reports correlate with the actual feel in the private mental world, okay? Because just what the person says they're feeling is itself just another reaction, just another bit of something else occurring in the public world. How that correlates with what's happening in the mental world, in the private mental world, that's a matter for theory. It could be that they are, as some philosophers speculate, they could be a zombie who is saying they are conscious without the consciousness actually being there. Sorry, I'm getting a little off track there. But the point is, we have this task of correlating private mental with the public physical, okay? And that's going to need both neuroscience and philosophy, okay, to do that. And that's going to be very important for determining which creatures are in pain, and which creatures feel anything, which creatures are conscious, and whether, for instance, AIs are conscious. And it's going to crucially have a philosophical element, a metaphysical element, a story about the correlations between these two different worlds. Now, one problem with that approach, if you take that approach, is that it's always going to be a matter of, well, I'm just going to say always going to be, there's probably never going to be consensus on this matters, precisely because there will never be consensus on the philosophical aspect. Okay. For instance, panpsychists say that electrons are conscious in a very minimal way, and they have philosophical arguments for that view. They think it's the most elegant, but other people are not impressed by those arguments, and they say no, they're not. How do you settle that? It's not clear that we'll ever. It's really a matter of what philosophical theory you find most congenial. You know, it's a matter of the overall elegance, theoretical elegance and economy and whatever. And of course, how seriously you take the intuitions you start with. So these questions about which creatures are conscious, and whether AIs are conscious, they're always going to be in the realm of philosophical dispute. We're always, so the possibility of skepticism about consciousness in other creatures is always going to be there. Now, if you take the sort of view that I take, then that's, you just don't have any of that problem, because there are no irreducibly private facts about creatures. The language of a private mental world is just this organism's way of describing the complex stuff that is happening within it. But there's nothing else happening within it. There isn't really a private world there. That's the metaphor that the organism uses to talk about itself. And once we've worked out how that metaphor maps on to what's really happening, that's it. Okay, so when we've worked out how, when I use the term I'm in pain, when I speak of myself being in pain, when we've worked out how that maps on to what's occurring in here, that's all there is to it. There's no question of whether that corresponds to what's happening in some private mental world that's accessible only to some inner self, okay? It's just this organism's way of characterizing its state at a certain time. Identify what that state is, and you've identified what pain is. Pain is completely public in that sense. Not public in the sense that you can easily, you know, I mean, it's stuff that's happening in literally inside my skull. Okay. So, yeah.
Just make sure I understood that. So as opposed to the phenomenal realists or panpsychists, when I say I am in pain, this maps onto my brain states directly, and this is how we can figure out whether or not fish feel pain as well.
Yes.
So it's dependent on, so instead of trying to find the correlate there, because we can never know the private state. In your case, you're saying the thing I use, the language I use to express this state I'm in, allows me to figure out whether or not this state exists in other people, because this is it.
Yes, talking about brain states is perhaps a little misleading, because what I mean is more, it'd be better to say activity.
Process. Yeah, like activity.
But the point is, the language, what we're looking for is not the correlates of pain in here. We're looking for the pain.
The pain, yeah. Okay. So this will help us with other creatures as well.
Yeah, what happens when we issue these reports is we are characterizing our state as organisms, okay? Hmm. In a very crude way. I'm in that complex pattern of sensitivity and reactivity that we call pain. Now, then we go to the scientist and say, what is that state? What exactly is happening in me when I apply this description to myself? We find out what that is. Then we look at what kind of patterns of reactivity happen in a fish, say, when it's injured, and say, now, they're not going to be exactly the same, obviously, but we look at the similarities. They're going to be, we try and look, what's happening to me is going to be immensely complex when I'm in pain. Okay, it's going to be these reactions that I'm talking about are going to be have multiple different dimensions. Okay, so think about some sort of complex, multidimensional space. Okay, where you can map strange objects within this multidimensional space, and that's represents the pattern of reactivity within me when I'm injured. Say, okay, and then I say I'm in pain, and that is what pain is. Okay. Now, then we do a similar thing. We map the pattern of reactivity within, say, fish. And then we sort of say, well, how similar is it to what we're talking about? Well, there's going to be probably some strong similarities and a few differences. And then we just say, okay, so that's how fish pain compares to our pain. And then we say, how much do we care about that? You know, are we concerned? Does that bother you enough to know that the fish is in that kind of state? But the point is, you're not looking now for the correlates, the physical correlates of something mysterious and private. You're looking at the thing itself.
At the thing itself.
That pattern of reactivity is the pain. Okay. So there's no longer any possibility of any skepticism here about the real facts being hidden from you in a private mental world that's only accessible to the organism, to the fish. The facts are there. They're not easy to discover because you've got to do really, really complex neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience or whatever on the creature. And it's going to be very, very, even the simplest creatures are very complex. But in principle, it's all there for us to find out. And we can map the degree of similarity and difference between this creature and us, and then ask ourselves how much we care about it.
But this is, in a way, also interesting, because in this case, for some reason, nature loves to hide comes to mind. And isn't this illusionism somehow, was it Heraclitus? No. Isn't this illusionism, in a way, this weird thing in nature whereby it's just trying to hide? In a different way, because in both cases something is hiding, we have the illusion, and in the other we just assume that there are these, you know, hidden mental states, the Cartesian theater. Why Maybe why is not even the right question here, but how, you know, like did this develop because of some sort of evolutionary kind of advantage? This is why maybe it's better for us to talk about the world this way, like language, or do we even know? Did this happen by chance? Is this the best way to communicate? And why the illusionism? Why do we have this illusion of things happening? Like, is this, maybe it's meant to be this way? I don't know. I don't know if I'm making sense. I'm thinking out loud, and I'm trying to.
No, you're making complete sense. Some would say that nature's hiding it. It's more that nature hasn't bothered to reveal it. Our Cartesian intuitions, I think, are due to the fact that we have limited awareness of what's happening within us. Our understanding of what's happening, our awareness of what's happening within us, is limited and partial and distorted. And that's why we have this rather crude picture. Okay? If we really had super self-monitoring systems that could really map in detail everything that's happening within us, in the way that, say, a future neuroscientist might be able to map the activity in very detailed regions of the brain in real time. And we could apply a complex neuroscientific theory to ourselves to articulate exactly how we're reacting to the world, we probably wouldn't have this sort of sense, oh, there's a sort of me in here watching this show sort of thing. That's our way of... that's our crude everyday way of conceptualizing ourselves that is sufficient for our purposes. We don't need that detailed self-understanding. You might compare it to thinking about free will. We have this sense that we can just make completely free choices that are not influenced by causal factors. And then that's kind of how it seems to us. We can just choose, but we don't have access to all the complex processes that led to that choice. You know, we kind of make up stories about ourselves in which we describe ourselves as making free choices. It's an interpretation, a rationalization. It's well known that introspection is very limited when it comes to talking about our own decisions, choices, and motivations, and so on. Okay, so why do we have it? Why do we have this picture? Well, because it was good enough. Now, what was it good? What's it for? Well, now this is an interesting question. There are various possibilities we can explore here. One is that really it's just for social purposes, just to enable us to talk about our experiences, just tell each other what it's like with us, how things are going with us, how the world is impacting upon us at any one time. Now, you could observe that just by observing my, you could tell that, I suppose, by observing my behavior. If you see me displaying all kinds of pain behavior, then you can see that it's the world's impacting on me in a very negative way. But when I have onsets of experience, I can just tell you about it. I can say, well, you weren't here. I was in terrible pain. Something happened that caused terrible pain. You don't need to be there to witness it. I can just tell you about it. And I can reflect on it, and I can think, I mustn't do that again because that caused terrible pain. So I can have a higher level of self-control. I can adopt strategies. I can decide that that experience was rather nice, and I'll try and see if I can cultivate it again. And I can form a plan to get the things that are necessary to make it happen, and so on. So I can exercise higher levels of self-control. I can describe my inner life. Well, I can describe my inner life to you and also to myself. So it's useful. And this crude Cartesian picture is good enough for that. I don't need to be talking about spiking frequencies in certain regions of my visual cortex, for heaven's sake. I can just say, well, yeah, it was a nice color, a yellow color, whatever. That will do. Now, that's one option, that it's just really for social purposes. Another possibility is that it has other functions. Nick Humphrey wrote a beautiful book in 2011 called Soul Dust, in which he argued that this
Who? Sorry.
Nicholas Humphrey.
Okay, Nicholas Humphrey, yeah.
Psychologist, has many areas of expertise, called Soul Dust, in which he argued that this, he used to talk it more in terms of illusion. He's not so keen on the term now, but he is, his view is essentially what I've been describing, that this, if you like, this Cartesian conception of ourselves was actually selected for in evolution because it had positive benefits. It gave us an enhanced sense of self, of importance. It made us seem more special to ourselves, and our existence in the world seem more, and the world in which we live seem more special to us. I won't try to summarize the arguments here, but he argues that the illusion was an adaptive one. So it wasn't just a byproduct of our of the usefulness of being able to talk about our condition. It actually had an independent fitness value. It enhanced our I guess our enjoyment of life and our tenacity in holding on to it.
As individuals and as social animals as well.
Both,
Yeah,
both,
because
both.
in
He
this
traces
case, because you're
that.
animals might be in pain, they might be defending each other, they might have tribes, but it's not the same as developing communities in the
Exactly.
sense of human beings. And see, this is this
And thinking of each, and thinking of this as a community, each with its
as a
own spark, you see.
Exactly, like this is the interesting bit. Like we're tribal animals, communal, etc. We live together, but at the same time, there's this tension between the individual and the collective. And somehow, this is maybe so. It's embedded in us in a way. However, whatever that is, the describe ourselves through stories as well, and this explains in a way myth and language and all sorts of stuff.
And so one thing that taking the illusionist perspective does is it invites us to consider these precisely sort of questions, to ask why is this Cartesian picture so compelling, and what does that tell us about our psychology, our evolution, our nature as social beings? Now, I suppose you still could ask those questions from a phenomenal realist point of view, but they're not foregrounded in the way that they are by illusionism. Instead, other questions are foregrounded, metaphysical questions, which I think are taking us away from the real center of interest, which is why is this Cartesian picture so gripping? And what does that tell us about ourselves?
Yeah, it's I there's a lot to process there because I'm trying my best not to take it to the Schelling and these people because like there's I've always been interested in how myth or myths in general develop and why we tell ourselves these stories. But then maybe the question is, yeah, that's because it's proven to be captivating for us and useful and all and that they just helpful in a way to keep us together. And maybe all this illusion, like, so we develop this illusion of ego, etc., blah blah blah. But also somehow, and the reason why this comes to mind is because I listened three when it came out, Philip Goff's discussion with Joe Rogan. Is this maybe why? So the ego is so based on what you're saying, it's also important for us to somehow not endorsing psychedelics or anything of the sort, right? But it's also important for us to let go a bit, to understand that this is not necessarily real in the real sense, but then this ego is some sort of illusion. And if this is something that Rogan talks about, and always, like, you know, once you're on a trip, you realize that this ego is just, you know, whatever that experience is, right? And then there's more to life and the world and nature and stuff than this thing, the me, the I, the whatever is.
Absolutely. I think this is a better picture of consciousness. Just reflecting on the philosophical problems of consciousness and how our everyday conception of mind is related to the scientific conception of the mind. I think this is just a better framework for thinking about it. But so asking, well, does it have, spiritual isn't the word I want. Does it have, is it, you know, does it have a comforting, reassuring aspect? Does it have emotional resonance that is positive or whatever? That isn't really relevant, I think, to assessing whether it's a good picture of consciousness. Okay. But having said that, I think it does. I find it a picture that I actually like. And then maybe that influences me to think it's the right picture in the first place. But I hope the reasons for thinking it's a good picture are independent of whatever personal reaction I have to it. But I do think it's a more humane and comforting picture, precisely because it means that, yes, we think of ourselves as these sealed off into these private mental bubbles that are inaccessible to anyone else. And we think of these little private mental bubbles as the source of all value. It's what happens in there that really matters, and whether that survives is what matters. And really, that's the whole story. And all the stuff around us, yeah, well, whatever, there's a world and there's other people, but it's this little bubble that's the, as far as, from this perspective, that's the only thing that, or the overridingly important thing. And so I guess I'm coming along and saying, well, yeah, that's a sort of illusion. Maybe it's a useful illusion. Maybe it's one that you can't really escape. But really, that is just a construction, a story that this biological organism is telling itself, maybe for very good reasons, but it's not getting at anything deep about reality. And really, this organism is just a very complex part of this wider world. It's not fundamentally metaphysically separate from it. And it's similarly not fundamentally metaphysically separate from the other organisms that are wandering around. We're all just part of this same complex world. And when this one stops working, that won't be the loss of some of the, you know, the overwhelmingly important thing in the world. It will just be the loss of one locus of complexity and sensitivity and interest. But there'll be lots of other ones continuing, and maybe those other ones will have been influenced by what this one did, and so they will carry on some of the sensitivities and so on that it had will be reflected in their own continuing sensitivities, and
this might explain why when everyone has the same experience when they're tripping, basically, mm-hmm. because it's kind of, you realize that everyone has we're organisms, part of nature, and all these stories we tell ourselves are just part of the ego. But in this case, so does this mean that consciousness somehow is an emergent property? Is this what you're saying or hinting at, or there's no emergence there? It's just the total. I don't know. Is it emergent?
What do you mean by emergence?
I don't know, but it's not necessarily not in the metaphysical stuff, but emergent in the sense that it's a little bit more than the sum of its parts.
That sounds dualistic. The little bit
dualistic.
More.
Okay.
Sounds dualistic. There's something that's something. There's the sum of the parts. And there's the parts doing all their things collectively and evolving in the ways that they do as a complex system. And then there's something, well, there's nothing else. There's just those parts doing whatever they do and evolving in the way that they do as a complex system.
But this complexity itself is...
The complexity, you could, yeah, and the complexity probably can't be captured at any level other than the level of the sort of high level of description. I mean, you're not going to be able to capture the way that the complex system unfolds by simply looking at the individual elements of it. But it doesn't mean that there's something sort of radically new brought into the world when this complexity occurs. There's the complexity, yes. But there's no emergence of something that needs, that sort of, whose existence is mysterious. There's two senses of emergence. There's the idea of when a system acquires a new level of organization, a new level of complexity, which perhaps couldn't be predicted, or at least not tractably predicted from understanding of its components. And then there's, which is sort of an epistemic notion of emergence, that it's something you were kind of surprised to see, that this pattern, these patterns are occurring. And then there's a more metaphysical notion, which is that something, when you've got this high level of complexity, something else happened as well. Like in the case of consciousness, you might think like the inner lights came on, you know, like a Cartesian theater sort of suddenly sprang into existence. That sort of emergence, no, I'm not. Okay. Not in a metaphysical sense, because then you have problems about explaining, well, what difference that would make. Does that then somehow interfere with does this extra feature somehow interfere with the development of the system? And does that have consequences for how the components behave? And yeah. I think you can tell it all in terms of complexity.
Interesting. Because maybe human beings and where we are now also on the evolutionary timeline, perhaps we're, I don't know, new things will evolve eventually, and weird stuff might develop. Because that's also something we ought to take into consideration. I'm just thinking in terms of, yeah, we are here, but then yeah, where this is heading somehow, and this is where the discussion probably about AI and all these technologies that we are developing. Is this a continuation of evolution, or does it end there? Blah blah blah. But
well, evolution doesn't have a goal, of course. I mean, evolution is just an adaptation to circumstance. Evolution can go, as it were, can produce simpler, less complex systems if they're the ones that are better adapted to the environment. Evolution isn't always a matter of increasing complexity. It's a matter of just adaptation to environments. So it might could be that maybe that we get replaced by AIs that are considerably less sophisticated than we are in many ways.
Maybe that's perhaps that may it might be even better as well, instead of complicating things, easing things.
I don't know. I'm enough of a humanist to hang on to our distinctive.
That's part of the narrative that this illusionism thing makes you believe, kind of, or not.
Well, yes. I mean, I should say that I'm not. These narratives. It's not part of the. It's not part of the theory or the position that these narratives we tell are ones we should give up. Calling them illusions doesn't mean we should stop. I mean, fiction would be another term. There may be fictions or illusions that we live by and that we should embrace and continue to cultivate. What I'm resisting is that I think we should take them seriously as accounts of reality. We can love our fictions and our stories without confusing them with reality. My problem is that a lot of philosophers and some scientists confuse them with reality and therefore send themselves off down research paths that are not going to go anywhere.
And Yeah, maybe we can start wrapping this up because I've taken way more than of your time than we had originally agreed on. So first off,
Oh,
thank you very
that's no
much
problem then.
because
I'm probably starting to get more and more incoherent as it goes on, so I'm less and less able to maintain my own narrative.
No, but it's so this is the thing. As we said at the beginning, like this is we're not trying to defend a position here, and this is where you're thinking out loud, I'm thinking out loud, I'm
Yeah.
trying to understand things. But then this what you said about the confusing reality and fiction, this is I don't know if you want to say anything about this before we kind of wrap it up, because it's interesting, and I'm just curious about what this means, or how this might take some scholars down rabbit holes, like the take fiction confusing it with reality.
Well, trusting one's intuitions about the reality of this phenomenal world means that you now have this huge metaphysical project of trying to relate those private inner qualities to the public world. So you have this huge metaphysical problem, and there's vast amounts of work being done on it. And indeed, I've no objection to it being done and explored. But I think it's at least worth considering the possibility that all that metaphysical castle building may be unnecessary. And similarly, I think that this, again, this pull of Cartesian gravity is felt by many scientists who feel that there is a problem here, the hard problem. I don't think I've mentioned that, but that's, of course, is the problem of explaining the relation between these mental qualities and what the brain is doing. They feel the pull of this, the need to address this hard problem. And I think that shapes some of what they do, and perhaps distracts them from other approaches that might be more fruitful, because that approach isn't going to be fruitful if I'm right. So it's at least worth considering that. I mean, what happens is when you change this perspective from the Cartesian one to the or the phenomenal realist one to the illusionist one, is that different questions come to the fore. Some questions drop out of the picture and new ones arise, like the one we were talking about how and why the illusion is created. Now, as I say, actually, that question can be asked within a realist framework alongside the other one, but it becomes the central question on an illusionist perspective. So, I'm sorry, I forgot what question I'm trying to answer here. Where was I?
Just like in a way, what does so I don't even know if I understood your point correctly the first time. But then, so for example, the narratives that we tell ourselves, fiction,
Right.
I don't know, are you talking about literature here and
Oh.
myths and stuff like that, or are we talking about a different kind of fiction?
I was talking about the stories we tell about our own minds.
Okay.
The
About the
description.
nature of consciousness and mind and stuff like that.
When you ask me to talk about my inner experience, okay, I and say what is it like to be you? Okay. And so I start trying to tell you things about the way things seem to me, okay? And there's a temptation to see that as characterizing, let's say, a private world that's only accessible to me. Insofar as it's interpreted that way, that's, I think, insofar as it's understood as characterizing an internal world, it should be thought of a private mental world that's distinct from the activity in there that's literally inside my skull, then it should be thought of as a fiction, more like a fiction. Okay. Not a fiction that's just made up out of whole cloth with no reference to reality at all. It's a fiction that's based on things that are really happening, but that is rendered through a fictional medium, through talk about the feels of the experience, the qualia of experience, and so on. So when I say fiction, I don't mean that it's got no basis in reality at all. It's like those fictions that are based on real people, but they've been exaggerated and distorted. Dennett uses this metaphor of the, which is probably one of the best ones, of the user interface on a computer, the graphical user interface on the screen of a computer that represents files and folders and waste bin and hard drives and so on. Now, those things there do correspond to things in the computer. I mean, the file, the document does correspond to something that's on your hard disk, some complex pattern of ones and zeros encoded on the hard disk. But it's not, there's not literally a little document with the, you know, there inside the computer that's stored separately, you know, in a little folder with all the other documents. It's just ones and zeros spread out across a hard disk. So it's a representation of something that's there, but it's a caricatured, distorted, massively simplified representation of it that is there for the purposes of control, to enable you. I mean, if you all have to remember the days before graphical user interfaces, when you had to use a command line prompt, copying
yes.
a file was much more difficult yeah. because you had to remember. And that, of course, is still at a fairly high level of language, the command line, not the machine language. The graphical user interface makes it much easier. You can drag things and drop things. It's not actually dragging anything anywhere inside the, nothing's being dragged anywhere. It's just that registers are being changed, you know, ones and zeros are being flipped or whatever. The idea is that our image of our own minds is analogous to that image of what's really happening within the computer. So it's tracking something real, and it's tracking it effectively for purposes of control. Just don't take it too literally. That's the that's the point. So my complaint would be that phenomenon realists are actually looking for those files and folders and things and all the waste bin inside the computer, not finding it there. Yeah. And saying, oh, so there's a hard problem. Somehow the computer is producing these things, but you know, we can't observe them inside it, so they must be private or what, or maybe
And this is kind of a nice way to summarize all this, because we came back to the same point about illusionism and what it is versus the phenomenal realists. And I'll just end with this, because I told you I asked on my Discord channel people like if they had questions, but then this is a good way for you maybe to see how lay people like myself and those in the community perceive of or what they conceive of illusionism when they hear the term. So this is, ask him to humor you for a few minutes and define the actions of a man who is absolutely convinced that neither he nor anyone else is conscious. Why would such a person get an education, get a job, etc., etc.? So I think what you clarified today is that it's not that there is no consciousness, or that consciousness is not real, or that our experience of the world is not real, or that they're not there. It's just illusionism, in the sense that maybe this is why people have a problem with the term. It's not because we think we experience things that are not there or whatever. And no, it's just that the trickery is in having us think that there is, these mental states are happy, or there's something in there that is interpreting these things as though they were real. Like I cannot even explain it as you do, but then to me it's way clearer now. It's just that we tell ourselves a narrative to conceive of the world in a certain way, which is not the case.
It's an invitation to rethink what consciousness is. It's not rethink what it's not that the suggestion isn't that you're not really in pain or whatever, you don't really see things. You know damn well when you're in pain, and you know it's bad and you don't want it. That's not the claim. Is the invitation is to realize that you may be conceptualizing pain and other experiences in a certain way that is influenced by the pull of Cartesian gravity.
Yeah.
And that there's another way of conceptualizing them. It's not even, as far as I'm concerned, it's not even saying, look, you must reconceptualize them in this way. It's just saying, just see that there is another way. I'm pretty convinced that there is another way, and I think I've managed to do it. And what I try to do when I talk about this is to try to communicate to people this alternative way of alternative conception. I don't know. I think I'm probably getting better at it. I'm a little bit tired. But I think there is one. And all I want from people is to just be willing to entertain the possibility. Okay. And just see if you can't get your head around what it is that I'm suggesting. Now, if you do, and you think, yeah, okay, I got that. I said, no, I still think the other one's better. Fine. Okay, fine. Absolutely no problem. But just try it first, because what I find for many people is that they are kind of locked into, as Wittgenstein said, they're in the grip of a picture. Or at least this is how I see it. They're in the grip of this picture. They're so under the pull of Cartesian gravity that they just can't see that there's an alternative.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, just try it out. You've nothing to lose. You won't suddenly stop experiencing things if you conceive them in this way. I mean, you won't suddenly be unable to feel pain or unable to see anything. That won't happen. The most that will happen is that you will have a different perspective on what's happening in those cases.
Yeah.
And you might have a different perspective on your own relation to the rest of the world and to other people. That might even be, you might even find helpful, positive. You might feel more part of everything, less isolated. More aware of how much of another person's mental life you can detect if you pay enough attention. If you think that fundamentally it's all inaccessible to you, all you've got are just these outward signs, you can never penetrate into their inner reality. Well, I think that's a rather sad view. I think that you can see if you pay enough attention.
Yeah, and it just, for some reason, this popped up. I don't know why, but maybe the fact that human beings can lie is indicative that maybe there is some sort of illusionism there. Like, we trick ourselves. Let's not discuss this. Let's not assert or not. It's just, for me, this now popped up. I'm like, if we can come up with all sorts of fictions and all sorts of lies and all sorts of, like, thinking about something as such, well, maybe this somehow indicates that at a certain level something is happening.
We live in a world of fiction. I mean, our narratives about our own lives. You asked me about my life. I will tell you a story.
Of course.
And what will happen is I will select out a few salient events, which I maybe don't even remember very well. I will emphasize their importance. I will connect them together with a certain narrative. And I'll say, that's what happened. That's how this happened. If you ask me to explain my actions this morning, I will tell you a certain story about how I thought I'd make a cup of coffee, because it's all interpretation. It's based on real things. There's real things happening. Real
of course.
Anyway, but our access, our understanding of access to them is limited and often distorted. And we invent because we need to try and explain ourselves to each other and to ourselves. Yep. We don't like to say, we come back actually to a nice thing about philosophy. We don't like to say, I don't know. You asked me what I believe about something. We started talking about Brexit, didn't we? You asked me what I believe about, think about Brexit. Well, actually, I have quite firm opinions on that. But other things, political things, we don't like to say, I don't know, really. I don't know. Well, no, confused. We like to have opinions, and so we make them up. We create them. We create a narrative of, I'm the kind of person who believes this, and I believe that, and this is very important to me. And, of course, once you've done that, then you've got to keep playing the part you've created for yourself. You've sketched a little part for yourself, and you've got to keep playing it. Otherwise, you're not being consistent.
Indeed, and the different paths and personalities. Absolutely. And Hume was onto something there.
I mean, that's okay. It's okay, because that's how we live. But just be aware that you're doing it.
Precisely.
That's the crucial thing. Don't mistake the story you've told for the the unvarnished reality.
Yeah.
Because you'll eventually go wrong somewhere because it is just a story.
Yeah, this is, I think this is a really nice way to kind of conclude the discussion, because this was, honestly, this was very, very interesting. I thought it would be more confusing, to be honest, because I've always been having difficulty. I've listened to your podcasts, I've had, and I've read some, like, what is illusionism, but I've always found it difficult to understand the problem or where this is coming from, etc. But then today, this conversation helped me a lot, at least, embrace this invitation to view things from a different perspective. And I don't have an issue with it. Mm-hmm. But see, you know, I don't know why people feel so strongly against or this. Maybe because, yeah, this narrative there to attach the...
That in itself, I think, is very interesting. Why people do feel threatened by this, I think. And that in itself is very interesting. And I don't mean it to be threatening. I really am the least threatening person. I'm not some sort of crazy scientist who wants to sort of dehumanize people, just the opposite. I just want to make them a little more self-aware, maybe.
Help
them to be a bit self-aware.
Thank you very much, Keith, for this. This was really, really interesting. And the usual, where can people find you? Any projects, books, etc., social media?
Well, they can find me on Twitter, of course, as we talked about earlier. It's just at Keith Frankish. I think there are two Keith Frankishes, but you'll recognize the one that's me. It's very distinctive. My website is keithfrankish.com, all one word, keithfrankish.com. You can find out more about me there than you will ever want to know. And if you follow me on Twitter, you will find out what I'm up to.
Are you going to at one point consider offering synchronous philosophy courses, or have you actually given those?
Well, it's an interesting
intro to illusionism or something.
I did a series of lectures for Moscow State University, which are linked on my website. They were just pre-recorded ones, so if people desperately want to listen to more of me talking, you can look at those. But yes, I might do something along these lines.
Yeah, maybe if you're interested, we can explore this possibility as well. We can do like I'll arrange everything just like I do with the invite. Like it's co-teaching. I just host and you would teach. We'll if you're interested, we can explore this further.
If people are interested, that might well be something that I'd be up for doing. I enjoy teaching very much.
Yeah, so you wouldn't mind doing that over Zoom as well, synchronously, if we...
That's certainly something I would be open to
explore. Okay.
Exploring. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. We can talk, because this is interesting. Like, and Philippe, we can do something, because Philippe is who co-teaches with me. He's a physics guy and a philosophy guy, and he knows a thing or two about mind and stuff. So it might be interesting to see how this pans out. But yeah, thank
Sounds
you
good.
Very much again. Thank you very much for your time.